Welcome to Cybersecurity Where You Are, the Center for Internet Security's podcast. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO at CIS.
And I'm Tony Sager, Senior Vice President and Chief Evangelist at CIS. Cybersecurity affects us all, whether we're online at home, managing a company, supporting clients, or running a state or local government.
So join us on Wednesdays as we discuss trends and threats, explore security best practices, and interview experts in the industry.
Together, we'll clarify these issues, creating confidence in the connected world.
Hello, and welcome to the show, Cybersecurity Where You Are. I'm Sean Atkinson, CISO here at the Center for Internet Security, joined by Mr. Joshua Palsgraf, our Senior Cyber Threat Intelligence Analyst. Joshua, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Sean. Thanks for having me. How are you today?
I am doing fantastic. And we have really great. I'm actually really looking forward to talking to you about this because we're talking now about cryptocurrency, how it plays necessarily in a digital economy, that economy also inhabited by cyber criminal, the financial crime activity in the space, and you know how organizations in that necessarily parenthetic are utilizing cryptocurrency for illicit activity, movement and transactional elements, the anonymity necessarily of certain elements within the blockchain. So we're going to be doing a lot of buzzword bingo today, Joshua, but really want to jump into this and, you know, just, you know, get a little bit on your background, you know, as a senior cyber threat intelligence analyst here at CIS.
Yeah, so I've been with CIS for about 5 years now. I primarily work on the data side, focused on our internal data sources, looking for trends and tactics, techniques, and procedures used by cyber threat actors, and tracking those to ensure that our members are kept up to date on those latest trends in order to better defend themselves.
Yeah, wonderful. And again, such a data-driven approach, really, to cybersecurity, right? Threat assessment. And I love the tactics, techniques, and procedures, because in that space, you know, kind of the topic here is we're looking at cryptocurrency. You know, what does that play necessarily in the wider digital economy? But it's also become necessarily a focus for both for cyber criminals and obviously investigators like yourself. So what role is cryptocurrency playing today?
Wow. So cryptocurrency has really, you know, became a huge role in not just today's digital economy, but within the cyber criminal or generic criminal economy as well. Firstly, cryptocurrency, you know, is used as a digital store of value. Investors like to use it to hedge against inflation or economic uncertainty, similar to how people have historically used gold. You often hear people compare Bitcoin to gold, saying that Bitcoin is digital gold. When it comes to other aspects of today's economy, it has, over the last 2 or 3 years, really come into a role of decentralized finance, or you'll hear people refer to it as DeFi. And digital finance platforms have reshaped how those types of services work. Users can borrow, lend, and trade cryptocurrency directly without having to go through traditional banks or financial services. Additionally, cryptocurrency is international and completely borderless. Sending money internationally via traditional banks usually takes a couple days, yet there's fees associated with it. But with cryptocurrency, sending cryptocurrency across the world is almost done instantaneous, and the fees associated with sending that money is significantly lower. And you really only need internet access in order to do that type of thing, which is especially important for people who don't have access to traditional financial services. So in that aspect, it does help a lot of people. With all of those things, though, comes the criminal aspect of it. Due to the decentralized nature of cryptocurrency, the ability to be somewhat anonymous, and the ease to transfer funds across borders really makes it appealing for criminals to conduct illicit activities. Additionally, one thing that really stands out is that cryptocurrency transactions have a reversibility to them. They can't be reversed. So once funds are sent, unless the person in control of where the cryptocurrency is sent sends it back, you're not going to get that back. So all of these factors really play into why criminals use cryptocurrency, which in turn allows investigators such as myself and others who deal with crimes associated with cryptocurrency to investigate those types of things.
Absolutely. It's such a fascinating subject. And you know, as you mentioned, where we're starting to see, you know, this irreversibility, there's a protection requirement necessarily around the cryptocurrency that you've collected. You know, we see that now becoming a part of elements of financial crime is actually theft of respective cryptocurrency that's been collected. And, you know, as you say, there's an ability in the borderless transactional nature and, you know, the digital ledger, as it were, on the blockchain really creates some interesting metadata necessarily for analysis. As you mentioned, there's the potential anonymity, right? It's there's still traceability in some cases. But really, when we're thinking, Josh, as the introduction of cryptocurrency, and, you know, some have seen it as a fad, and, you know, we keep looking at Bitcoin, it goes up, it comes down. As you said, you know, that there's certain utility to hedging against inflation and certain other macroeconomic activity. But now we see cryptocurrency. We also see flavors of cryptocurrency necessarily with Bitcoin, Ethereum, Doge, and all different kind of coins that are, I guess, digitally minted, you know, the best way I can come up with that. But as we've seen the rise necessarily, it has fundamentally changed both financial funding of crime, but then also fraudulent elements of financial crime as well. Am I thinking about that the right way, Josh?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely increased in those areas. Traditional financial crime like credit card fraud was often easy to trace due to going through traditional financial services and regulated channels like banks. With cryptocurrency, it operates decentralized, making tracing it, you know, complicated. And, you know, like you said, the transactions are reversible, which makes things a bit more difficult. And, you know, this has really had a huge impact on financial crime specifically. There's a report by the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center, or IC3, from 2013. I don't believe their 2014 report has came out yet. But in that report, they indicated that cryptocurrency-related financial crime only accounted for about 10% of all the complaints they received. However, 50% of the financial crime losses was from cryptocurrency, and that totaled a little over $5.6 billion, which is a significant sum of money in the United States that is being associated with crime. And those crimes are often scams, and specifically investment scams, where people think they're investing in a legitimate project, or, you know, they're getting into something good and to make money, only to find out that they've lost all their money and that, you know, they were completely scammed out of their investment. And then if you want to even like broaden that to like a global approach, there's this company called Chainalysis. And Chainalysis is really good because they monitor a lot of illicit cryptocurrency wallet addresses. And their 2024 report they put out stated that in 2024, illicit cryptocurrency addresses received a little over $40 billion, which really, you know, shows the magnitude and highlights the scale of cryptocurrency being used with crime.
Absolutely. $40 billion. My goodness. And I think, you know, when I was kind of doing some research, so literally I could keep up with you, Joshua, and your work in the space, was that, you know, some estimates are, you know, there's illicit addresses. And ultimately what we're seeing is some payments have decreased, some are increasing. We're starting to see a lot of kind of nation state continuing to utilize both scams and stolen funds as representative as part necessarily as an approach that they have to funding an economy within a respective country, which is incredible. You know, that we've now got to the point that necessarily financial crime is actually a form of funding of certain countries. It becomes just mind-boggling to, you know, to think when we go back to what cryptocurrency was and how it gets augmented over time to what it is today. You know, I'm not sure that it necessarily was envisioned in terms of certain of the attack elements, as well as the utilization in funding and being profitable in certain attack strategies was, you know, maybe part of the conditions of creating a cryptocurrency way back when. And I know there's, you know, with Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, there's a particular individual who's identified as the creator, but no one knows who it is because it was a pseudonym and, you know, all of these different things. So it makes even the invention necessarily quite mysterious, right? And has those elements. And with that, we'll be right back after this quick break. Don't know how to meet the standard of reasonable cybersecurity? Well, you won't get there by putting a fancy lock on the server room door.
Right, Sean. CIS Secure Suite comes with integrated tools and resources for implementing a reasonable cyber defense program.
Now, let's not forget about testing. You can also use a CIS Secure Suite membership to evaluate the reasonableness of your cyber defenses using risk quantification.
And this will help you to comply with U.S. and state data privacy laws and show you've implemented the necessary security measures to avoid liability in the event of a data breach.
And now through April 30th, you can save up to 20% on a new membership using promo code RCD25.
So, want to make your cyber defense program reasonable?
Well, you need a CIS Secure Suite membership to build and test it.
Visit cisecurity.org/CIS-Secure Suite to learn more.
Thank you. And let's jump back into the episode.
So we talk $40 billion. You know, there's estimates that potentially that could increase to over $50 billion, you know, for 2024's activities. Again, depending on how you identify and illicit addresses and things of that nature. But in your mind, when you're thinking about criminal activity in the space, are there any notable examples of where either cryptocurrency has been linked necessarily to a crime or to elements where you've seen it being either a motivator or a condition of part of your threat intelligence gathering as an identification of, you know, some notable use cases or case studies that you've seen or that you utilize in some of your training and, you know, some of your practice necessarily to identify indicators where you're starting to see cryptocurrency being a vector of attack. Any that come to mind, Josh?
You really nailed that on the head there. I mean, like we said, it's related to fraud and scams. But really coming down to those kinds of where countries are trying to steal cryptocurrency and use cryptocurrency in order to fund an economy. You really nailed that one on the head. And probably the most recent, most notable and notorious example of that would be the 2024 DMM hack, which was attributed to the North Korea group called Lazarus. What they did was they hacked DMM and got access and were able to manipulate legitimate transactions in order to steal Bitcoin from that company. And they stole, at the time, Bitcoin, the amount of Bitcoin they stole was worth around $308 million. And this wasn't the first time that this occurred. And when it comes to nation states or groups, you know, affiliated with nation states, Lazarus Group and groups associated with North Korea in particular have really been at the forefront of that type of activity. You know, once again, I'll refer to a report by Chainalysis where they put out doing research on this. And in 2024, North Korean affiliated hackers stole around $1.3 billion across 47 different attacks, just going out. And you could call them cyber attacks, or you could even call them heists, like a traditional bank heist movie, or back in the old days. I was always really a big fan of those types of movies. And so they go through and they get initial access and they steal cryptocurrency from companies and exchanges in order to fund an economy and to use those funds, which is something, like you said, no one ever really considered that use case for cryptocurrency. I mean, cryptocurrency was, you know, created, gosh, probably over 10 years ago, 2008, 2009. So it's been around for a long time, and only recently, like these types of, the last 5 years or so, these types of activity has really occurred. But besides, you know, high profile attacks to steal cryptocurrency from companies in order to fund an economy, the most notorious examples I think everyone has heard about are ransomware attacks, where, you know, actors and groups are, you know, demanding cryptocurrency for the ransom. And so that has really, the use of cryptocurrency for the ransom has really driven that ransomware economy that we've seen. And I do think that one thing you said is really important, that, you know, from 2023 to 2024, you're really right, because the amount of cryptocurrency related, particularly for ransomware, has decreased, which is a very good thing. And although it's still considerably high, around $813 million in cryptocurrency for ransomware payments were received by threat actors in 2024, according to Chainalysis, with the largest payout ever, you know, publicly known, which was $75 million to a ransomware group called Dark Angels. But I do think, out of, you know, all of that bad, that positive, that due to the collapse and takedown of some particularly notorious ransomware groups like Lockbit and Black Cat or Alpha V, ransomware payments did decrease from 2013 to 2014. And hopefully that's the start of a new trend.
We hope so. Right. The other interesting thing there, and that was excellent, Josh, because it's, you know, one that leads me to thinking about this is it's those ransomware payments that we don't know about, right? And that are not going to get publicized, and that we're starting to see, you know, hopefully the trending, you know, continuing in the space. Because ultimately, if I'm going to think about it, and you know, this is just my own thoughts here, I look at ransomware as being enabled, or the catalyst for that to be so successful is cryptocurrency, right? Because if we use credit card, that's easily traced. You know, we've got reversible capability in that area. You know, some of the defining elements that you mentioned in the beginning of the podcast leads us to a capability in the space to, one, build confidence from an attacker's perspective. I'm going to get paid, or necessarily, there's going to be, a denial of service necessarily, as ultimately either systems are rebuilt or infrastructures recreated or managed appropriately from systems that have suffered basically a ransomware attack. I also see, threat actors in the space, and you mentioned it, there's the financial fraud elements for money laundering, that borderless digital capability of transference of literally bits, zeros and ones across the internet is transactional, and that necessarily we can't identify. And I also see, would love your perspective on this, obviously of any of the respective threat actors' utility, but the dark market utilization, right? It's a perfect currency in that space to utilize for necessarily illicit activity, illicit product and service in darknets that ultimately lead us to this point of where there's discussions about regulation for cryptocurrency, and ultimately how are there methods of control management, and it being such a, a utility in the threat actor's, transactional process. And ultimately, I'll use capitalistic approaches to, one, to commit such crime, right? There's a financial incentive, and now there's an easier way, a way of receiving that respective payment that gives you such a powerful stance in being able to proliferate and continue to do this. Now, in some cases, we've seen with certain other attacks, it's kind of a one and done, because I've burnt that approach necessarily, that credit card use, the stealing of the respective personal data, and transactional data. That's kind of a burn, one and done. I get paid, I move on. All the ATM type attacks where, I can use it basically withdrawing until I reach either a certain limit or it's identified as fraudulent and then stopped. That's opportunistic. Here, necessarily, you've laid a foundation that allows this to continue. And even, we've seen decreases, we've seen increases. But I mean, when you get into the billions, I think that really defines an infrastructure that threat actors can leverage. And not against cryptocurrency, but its application, as mentioned, I didn't ever think necessarily that they would say, oh, yeah, we're going to give the bad guys kind of a leg up in the space and, utilize it in this way. It's as a thought exercise, and then its actualization. Very, very interesting. But if there's a way for it to be used for nefarious things, it will be found, used, practiced. And now, as we respectfully identify, it becomes its own economy. Any thoughts on those perspective, Josh? Anything you would add to those thoughts?
Yeah, you really mentioned it, specifically with like darknet marketplaces, allowing that. Once very small portion of illegal activity to really flourish into a huge, almost side economy, to be able to sell goods and services like drugs, weapons, stolen data, malware, and then receive payment in cryptocurrency, has really made that flourish and even pushed off and sprouted off other types of services that we're seeing, whether it's ransomware as a service or malware as a service, where, a threat actor creates and manages the malware and other threat actors can purchase it and purchase support and get support to troubleshoot when they have issues and stuff. It almost is like IT support to some extent, or a managed service provider for malware, which is really fascinating how that kind of like exploded into the cyber crime scene. And especially another one thing I'll mention is the money laundering aspect of it, which isn't just used by cyber criminals, but it's also used by ordinary criminals that we, you know, gangs, cartels, organized crime, you name it. They also use cryptocurrency to launder that type, launder the money that they make. And as, you know, cryptocurrency and that space has really evolved, so has, you know, investigators' abilities to track it, as well as criminals' abilities to hide it with their use of mixers or tumblers, where they can send their cryptocurrency to this service. It gets split up and mixed in with thousands of other transactions, and then slowly over time sent back to a different wallet that you control in smaller increments, so it can't be traced. So you really got straight to the point with that one. It's all very, very fascinating.
Well, I mean, there's so much now that I'm seeing kind of in the investigative space, right? You know, professionals such as yourself looking at this and looking at, you know, blockchain analytics, looking at forensic assessment necessarily of attribution and transaction mapping and potentially cluster analysis to address, you know, certain cryptocurrency addresses, right? Do they have the same control, the same utility, the same usage? Are we starting to see, you know, transactions on certain dates, times, that we can align with certain timelines of ransomware and things of that nature? So there's kind of a, what I would call it, it's kind of a metadata forensic analysis of the blockchain necessarily that can help identify and really address some of the risk that exists. You know, when we're thinking about that and in this space, Josh, are you starting to see, you know, from a fraud investigation perspective, because it really combines a lot of different elements. There's a digital forensic transactional element, right? There's the fraud necessarily in terms of financial crime. There's the tactics, techniques, and procedures that we get from our threat acting and obviously threat intelligence. Does all of that combine into what would become kind of blockchain or cryptocurrency forensic or tooling in this space? And you know, you'd mentioned a really great group, Chain Analysis, who do a lot of work in this space. Are these the types of tools, the types of situational awareness that investigators like yourself should have in order to now start to utilize this data in a way to identify and even in some cases try to prevent such activity from occurring?
Yeah, some of those tools are definitely helpful in terms of analyzing the blockchain and tracking those cryptocurrency addresses. Essentially, what these tools or platforms do is they analyze public ledgers of the transactions, looking for suspicious activity and linking known illicit addresses and patterns of behavior, whether that's indicating money laundering or fraud. And an analyst can take a cryptocurrency wallet address from an investigation, such, you know, as a ransomware attack, and track where those funds are going from wallet to wallet to wallet, which is time consuming and can be quite difficult to do, because by that point you may know or give that cluster of that investigation, if it's related to a group or a known group or a new group, and you're to get to the endpoint, which isn't something that I work with, but what others do is they will wait, and it's essentially a waiting game for the threat actor or for the criminal to mess up, because eventually they're going to need to take that cryptocurrency and send it to an exchange or somewhere in order to exchange that for fiat currency or government-backed currency, whether that's the US dollar or the pound or the euro.
100%. Yeah. I think from the forensics perspective, it's, I think, the Dorbert standard. You're always going to leave a trace somewhere, right? There's always going to be a way. In some cases, it takes very, very strong analytic capability in order to do that. But again, I think the tools are getting more sophisticated. And obviously, we're starting to see that there is a financial reason to invest and to build forensic capability to look at, you know, smart contracts, blockchain analytics, obviously cryptocurrency exchange, movement necessarily across the public ledger, right? Obviously, it's distributed for the whole reason, you know, necessarily why it was built. And just leads us down a path of, you know, really continued cutting edge assessment in this space. You know, I'd be remiss if we didn't mention, for buzzword bingo, at least AI being utilized as part of another assessment and pattern matching in this area, right? It is going to be a contributing factor as we look at the techniques that are used in this space. And honestly, you know, Josh, just for the final element of the podcast, I think this is, I don't know that this is going away necessarily. And I think we just need to invest and start to build awareness, right? Both from a Web3 perspective in terms of the enablement of such capability, and then ultimately understanding the technologies is all going to be part of, I think, a threat intelligence professional's tradecraft. Does that make sense in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. It's something, although cryptocurrency has been around for a long time, I would still consider that space to be relatively new, and it's going to continue to change, and it's going to adapt and evolve over time. And I think we're really only starting to see the beginning of that process from when it, you know, was created with Bitcoin and all of the other cryptocurrency coins and tokens that have followed it into what we see now. In 5 to 10 years from now, it might be a completely different sphere that we're looking at, whether it's from a digital financial point of view or looking at crime and how there it's related to criminal activity and how threat intelligence professionals are, you know, analyzing those transactions and looking at it. But in its current state, at the very least, I like to think that there are a bunch of things that intelligence professionals can do to counter, you know, different illicit activity in order to, you know, stay ahead in order to protect the organizations that they work for.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Josh, that brings us to the end of our episode. I just want to say thank you. I'm again glad you and your team are thinking about these things, doing work in the space to assess, understand the threat landscape, and be able to help inform our membership and the wider community with all the threat intelligence products that you put together. So a big thank you to you and your team. And thank you again for being on the podcast. And I want to thank our audience. Thank you for listening. We appreciate you being here with us through our crypto adventure. Remember, subscribe in all the usual ways on your favorite podcasting platform. We are on YouTube at The CI Security. So remember to click that subscribe button. click the bell for notifications of uploads of episodes like this and much, much more. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the podcast today.
The thoughts and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are solely theirs and do not necessarily reflect those of CIS.
Tune in on Wednesdays for a new episode. And in the meantime, visit our website at cisecurity.org.
Together, we'll continue our efforts of creating confidence in the connected world.